You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast.
Number 174, Aula Education, interview with Anders Krohn. Hi, this is Rod Murray. Welcome back to my podcast. That was a teaser from Woods of Chaos by Rob Kostlow. If you like New Age piano like I do, I'm sure you will enjoy his piece. Stay tuned for the full piece at the end of my podcast. Before we get started on the main topic today, I wanted to give a plug for the U-Sciences eLearning 3.0 conference, which is being held this May 14th, 2019. This year, the conference theme is the future of learning platforms. In fact, we have a great speaker. Our keynote presenter will be Phil Hill, who will be presenting on the future of e-learning platforms. So, of course, I'll have a link in my show notes, but please check it out. The site is usciences.edu/elearningconference. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all of the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. For my main topic today, I'll be playing my interview with Anders Krohn, who's the CEO and co-founder of Aula Education. Now, if you're like me, you may not have heard of Aula Education. Turns out they're a UK company without much of a presence in North America as yet, but that may change. I think the story of Aula Education can be summed up in what happens when you start from scratch to build a learning platform. According to them, the core digital infrastructure of most LMSs is not built for engagement, and I certainly agree with that. They wanted to challenge assumptions around the core infrastructure and alter what digital education means and what it feels like to study. Alice says, quote, when combined with thoughtful pedagogical design, they have the potential to enable great teaching and create more active learning communities. We discuss the meaning of the name Aula, how Aula got started, what they mean by social and conversational pedagogy, integration with various other systems such as the SIS, and how do they work with LMSs? How do faculty respond to Aula? In fact, can Aula replace an LMS? And have there been institutions that have dumped their LMS in favor of Aula? Stay tuned in here. Without further ado, here's my interview with Anders Krohn. Anders, thank you so much for joining me today on my podcast. I'm really excited to hear about your product. Before we get started in the details, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you ended up starting, co-founding this company, Aula Education?
Definitely, yeah, and thank you so much for the invitation. So if we start with my background, which I think is obviously quite important in terms of understanding why Aula exists today, I have a pretty strange or weird, say the least, educational background myself. I grew up in Denmark, a small country in Northern Europe that's known for having free education. And then when I was about 18 years old, I went on a bit of an educational journey, which first took me to the rural south in the U.S., to University of West Georgia, which was 1 hour west of Atlanta. And as you can probably imagine, University of West Georgia is quite different from studying in Denmark and the rural south in the U.S. compared to sort of small country in Northern Europe, very, very different in terms of student demographic, in terms of what it means to be an academic, in terms of basically everything. So that was my first exposure to sort of education outside of Denmark, and it was really quite a fantastic experience. I got to learn a lot about the importance of education to regions, the importance of education to people who are first-generation students, the importance of education to low-income students, and things that I had not really been acquainted with in Denmark. So that was quite an eye-opener to me. I then went back to Denmark, studied for a bit there, and then went to the UK, to Oxford, which is another very sort of peculiar educational experience, which I think really emphasized to me the importance of conversations and dialogue in education. But it also emphasized another thing, which is that you can do a lot of things when you have enough resources. And there are lots of resources at Oxford in terms of academics, time and money and other things, which is definitely not the case. I think it's, and or it's, I know it's not the case for the vast majority of educational experiences in the world. And then I had a brief stint at Peking University in China. So I've been around at 5 different universities in 3 continents. And I think what really, to me, is the most important thing from all those experiences is that it's not so much about the institution, it's not so much about the background, it's really about what can the individual educator or academic do for the individual student. And I think one of the things that's, I think, is most important in education is that education continues to be a personal experience, not just a sort of personalized experience, but something where you actually belong to something when you go through education, that is not just about content, it's about conversations inside of the classroom, outside of the classroom, and that it's that sense of community and it's being with other people that, to me, is the most important part of education. And that's very much shapes the way that I think about what we do at Aula as well.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, it sort of makes you wonder how that kind of an experience, on ground, face-to-face experience, could possibly be replicated in an online environment. Is that what you expect to do?
Actually, it's not. To me, it's not about replication. To me, it's about understanding what works and then trying to think about what is it that online can do that can take some of those things that work in classrooms, such as conversations or interactions, but can also leverage the fact that you're moving to digital space to create new types of experiences. And I think when it comes to digital, not just in education, but anywhere, really what digital can do is, one, it can provide access to people who did not otherwise have access. Two, it can help you scale. And three, it can create new types of experiences. And so I don't think it's about replicating what happens in the classroom. I think it's about understanding what are the fundamentals of good education and how can you bring that online as well so that you get the benefits that digital provides. And I think one of the things that sometimes I'm a bit skeptical of educational technology, in the sense that there's sometimes, in my opinion, sort of digital in education can often be sort of solutions chasing problems rather than solutions to real problems. And I think that's an important distinction, that technology should be used to the extent that it helps us create better and more engaging educational experiences.
Sure. You know, I'm reminded of my daughter's own experience in going to her first choice university was NYU. And she sat in a lecture hall, introductory biology with 800 students. And she didn't even meet anybody because she was sitting next to somebody different each day. And, it was very discouraging. And she ultimately transferred out. So, I totally am with you there. Okay, so you had quite an experience. I'm curious what your take was on I'm sure you experienced in several learning management systems. Did you at that time? Did you experience different ones? Or what did you think about LMSs at that time, or wasn't a focus?
To be honest, I don't think I had a strong opinion on it. Like, I don't think, and I think that's something, sometimes when you are working in educational technology, you think that people in education think that educational technology is more important than it actually is. I don't think I knew the name of my LMS.
How about that?
And I think, or I know I didn't know the name of my LMS. Now I know. I knew that I was frustrated with some of the things that were the sort of wider digital infrastructure at all the universities, really. But I think the reason for starting Aula was not really just about frustration. People often talk about frustration when they start companies. It was more actually being drawn to an opportunity that it was very clear to me that the use of conversational technologies or chat-based technologies, the ones you will know from things like Slack or WeChat or Microsoft Teams, had a huge potential to take some of the things that I thought was most important in education and make that the norm. So that if you take, for example, you mentioned your daughter's experience at NYU, that's a really common pattern in what it means to be a student nowadays. And that's, in my opinion, is a catastrophe. It's like it doesn't make any sense that we don't use the fact that technologies outside of education are now at a stage where really the main thing they do is that they connect people, they help people collaborate, they help people engage with each other. And yet we don't use that to create more engaging, more sort of sense of belonging educational experiences. And it was more of that I was drawn to. I did not like my LMS. I think if you ask most students, they don't like it. And it's not driven by hate or anything. It was just driven by the fact that I felt there's a huge opportunity to improve the state of education, enhance the way that people learn by using those technologies to really take what I think is most important in education and do that at scale.
So how did you get up the nerve and to kick off your own company? And does the name Ala have a significance?
So maybe just a step back on that one. So I created a completely different company when I was in the first year of my university. And that was an events platform for universities. So completely different thing. That was before Facebook events was good. And so that didn't really work. And 2 years into that journey, platforms like Slack and Facebook Messenger were starting to really take off. And that's how the team that was working on that events platform, so me and my co-founders, got the idea for what is now Ala. So we did what people call a pivot, a pretty big one. And the name Ala is in many ways encapsulates what we're trying to do. So Ala, it means different things in different languages. One of the things it means in Latin is the sort of the place where people come together. In Spanish, it means classroom, and I believe in a few other languages as well. And for me, that's what it's all about. It's about bringing people together. And I think I see so many examples of educational institutions. I visit usually 1 to 2 universities a day where they've invested like hundreds of millions in making their campuses more collaborative, more engaging, bringing people together. And yet pretty much all universities I visit, like 95% of their online experience is PowerPoint slides and grades. And then some academics are going out of the way. They're using Slack, they're using Facebook groups to solve this problem. But that, to me, should not be going out of the way. That should just be the norm. That's how it should be. And that's really what we're trying to help universities achieve.
Well, interesting. I mean, that's what attracted me when I heard about your company was the idea that you could replace the learning management system. That seems like a pretty bold statement and goal. Tell me, walk me through that. I mean,
what does that mean in practice?
Yes.
So maybe let's take a big step back on where I think it went wrong. So if you look at the history of the learning management system, one of the things that the learning management system has been successful at doing is bringing educational institutions into digital spaces. I think it's fair to say, and I think if you read most of the EDUCORE's work on next generation digital learning environments, will confirm this, that it's not been particularly successful, at least not at scale and at least not outside of pockets of innovations, to engage people in digital spaces. So what we did when we started Ala was we said, okay, what if we had a blank piece of paper? There had not been like thousands of RFPs that had forced companies to create sort of monolithic applications that have thousands of features. What if we really took a step back and what should the digital student experience look like? And you can then ask, okay, why do you want to replace the LMS or not? For me, the reason the LMS doesn't make sense in what I think will be what should be the digital student experience of the future is that in order to have conversations in digital spaces, those conversations cannot be separated from the content. So the really important thing is we're not trying to create a better discussion format. I mean, we're trying to rethink the way that the digital student experience is. And that includes making the LMS obsolete. And so that sounds good on paper. So your question, of course, as well, is like, what happens in reality? So in reality, when we work with our partner institutions, what we do is we run a pilot, which is usually a year. And during that pilot, we put the LMS in the background, which means that it's usually used as a grade book or for assessment for things we don't want to disrupt during the pilot phase. In order to prove that we can impact what the institutions care about, so I mentioned before, like survey results around community, interactions in digital space, the extent to which academics see a reduction, email communication, all those things that matters to whether the investment is worthwhile and whether it has the educational impact. So that happens during the pilot. And then we start doing integrations with things like student information system, with things like third-party tools like Turnitin. And we'll probably build some quote-unquote third-party tools ourselves to make this ecosystem work. But really, from a student experience perspective, they don't realize that the LMS was a thing, right? Because now the state of educational technology is in a place where there's a sufficient number of tools that are adopted across these institutions. There's just actually not a need to have this monolithic application at the core. And we're not saying that there won't be trade-offs. Like we'll have to have a hard conversation with the university and say, we don't think necessarily your SCORM object should exist because it doesn't really work well on mobile, or maybe a wiki is not the future. There is an element of this that saying, let's focus on what's most important, which is engagement, is community, is collaboration, and build around that. That's basically how we get there. So where we're at now is we have one university that uses Aula for all their students, and where the LMS is only used for some assessment pieces and hopefully phase out later this year. And then we have a number of large pilots with universities in the UK. We don't have any partner institutions in the US yet, but we'll probably have the first couple in the next few months. Really taking a step back and looking at what do those universities want their digital experience to look like in a couple of years' time. Definitely see a future worthy without the LMS.
Now, I don't know the way it is in Europe, but I know here it seems that there's more and more of an emphasis on assessment.
Yeah.
And outcomes measures. So is this something that you've built into your product, or is that something that's, because, different LMSs have their own solutions. We happen to use, a third-party solution for assessment called APHIS, which came out of Drexel University here in Philadelphia. So it sort of plugs in, sort of sits between our student information system and the LMS. So what do you say to someone who says, well, do we have to throw away our existing assessment platforms, or do you have your own? How does that work?
It really depends on the institution. So we have an application we built ourselves. It's a separate app that integrates with Aula that's used for some formative assessment. Many of the institutions we work with use things like Turnitin as well, or PeerGrade, or other assessment tools. So I haven't seen an institution yet where, when you actually look at their digital portfolio, where it's not possible with the Aula platform to phase out the LMS over time. But I think you have one thing that's important in what you said was that a lot of institutions are looking at assessment. But what does it mean to look at assessment? To me, that does not only mean looking at the tools. It also means looking at, what is it actually we're trying to achieve, right? So, for example, if you have institutions that are more focused on vocational training or education, maybe assessments should be more authentic. Maybe it's not really a plagiarism check that's important for those institutions. Maybe it's about making sure that those students can use the tools that they want to use when they go out in the workplace. Those are the conversations we have with these institutions. And I think that's when it gets most interesting. And where we have taken quite an opinionated, I would say, approach and said, we don't sell just software. We always have what we call an engagement partner working with the institution. So they will usually be former educators themselves. And with project management experience, saying, what is it we're trying to achieve over the next year or 2 years to get to an institution where the institution's, well, at senior leadership level, where the institution's education strategy actually materializes in learning experiences. And that can sound quite abstract, but actually I think when I've seen spaces being used on Aula by academics and students, that very much actually happens. when you make it really easy for people to use a product, when it's similar, familiar to what they're using outside of education, it's very easy to get communities going, it's very easy to think differently about assessment. And obviously, there are things that relate to regulations where you cannot get rid of sort of the traditional way of operating. But I think most universities have a couple of academics, if not groups of academics, who've really gone out of their way to create a fantastic educational experience. It's like, and that's really what we're trying to do with these institutions, but across the institution.
You know, in looking at your website, just to clue our listeners into some of the terminology that you use, I'm curious, what's the difference between, you call them spaces, would that be corresponding to a course site? Is that a place where you create documents, or do you use other document stores?
So the space is a bit similar to a feed in a Facebook group or a general channel in Slack. A space has a feed and it has material. And the feed is where sort of the beating heart of the class, where students will start discussions, academics will share content, and where it's more sort of a lively thing that happens throughout the term. And the material is for more of the sort of the backbone of the course, assessment integrations or links to videos that the students have to watch. And so the space is used for a module or for a program or for a course, or depending on what the institution calls them. So for example, at a UK institution, you would usually have, similar to in the US, you would have you're an economics major, you do Econ 101, Econ 102, Econ 103, and then each of those would have a space. But what we're seeing now as well is that some institutions start to use spaces maybe at the program level to create a sort of coherent narrative about what does it mean to be an economics student. So we are starting to see sort of more organic and interesting ways for spaces to be used. But it is at this sort of one-to-one with the module in the LMS when the migration happens, but not in an as-is fashion, in a way where we actually take a step back and look at what are the learning outcomes and how does that tie into this more conversational social type of pedagogy.
I see. Yeah, it seems that it would fit nicely with there's more, as a professional school here, we're very much interested in interdisciplinary education. Mm-hmm. So it seems that, and it doesn't always fit into, the typical LMS course structure. You have many courses that are taught different colleges within our institution. And so then we have to merge the courses. And it seems that this, if I'm understanding you, this would be organized a little bit higher level.
That's a bit hard to explain on a podcast.
Sure.
It depends on the institution. I would say it's in terms of how we go about the migrations in practice. If we look at the LMS, which usually has core sites or module sites, and we migrate those. But then sometimes we would also ask questions about whether there is a need for space to be created to serve different purposes.
So do you leverage systems that schools might already have? For example, I've been here 10 years. One of the first things I did was, establish us as a, Google sites, Google Apps for Education school. So yeah. we get the free use of Google. So do you leverage that to power your system?
I was leverage is even a small word. It's almost a necessary condition for success for us, I would say. I mean, we work with institutions that have a pretty small digital portfolio. Most institutions will either be a Microsoft or a Google, I would say. Many would have a turned in license, and then some would have more different types of assessment solutions and video solutions and stuff. But one of our big bets, and one of the reasons we think that institutions should really try and not think about a monolithic approach to their digital portfolio, but about an ecosystem approach where it's about getting the systems to speak together. And that's really what we're trying to achieve. So we would very much leverage things like Google Forms or YouTube or other things. That's part of creating this rich digital environment and really make it more exciting, less monolithic, less sort of in a box and more something that's familiar and interesting to students.
So rather than being an off the shelf product, it's more, I guess, a customization process that the school would go through.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of integration?
Although I would say all institutions, we haven't met an institution yet that doesn't have the basics in terms of like a student information system, like Google or Microsoft, and some sort of assessment solution, and you get a very long way with that. So it's, it really depends on where in their journey they are.
So do you subscribe to various standards, like IMS standards, to make sure that you have interoperability among these different components?
So for some tools, we do need things like LTI. To be completely honest, I do think there is a big piece in the ed tech space to try and have a look at some of those interoperability standards in terms of fit for purposeness, especially when it comes to mobile integrations. So one of the things we can see across all our institutions, we have 50% more interactions on mobile than on web. And I think a lot of the interoperability work that's been done is very focused on web. Whereas if you look at, for example, things like Slack or Microsoft Teams, they've done a brilliant job on top of conversational platforms to build integrations that actually fit into the more natural workflow. So the short answer is yes, we do use some of those standards, but we also do think quite creatively about what we think should be sort of API architecture of the future.
These days, one of the biggest buzzwords is artificial intelligence. Yeah. Do you build in any tools, machine learning, AI, that helps to lubricate the conversations between faculty and students?
Not at this moment, no. I very much think that all technology companies need to look at the potential of what machine learning can do for their products. But I think this comes back to one of my first points, which is to not have solutions chasing problems. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll definitely see like relevant scenarios with chatbots or other things where machine learning will be leveraged on top of our platform, or where it would make sense for us to do it ourselves. But I think right now we're just so focused on building a core product that makes sense, that's focused on increasing student engagement, creating a sense of community, and really just making a simple, nice, sort of more familiar core digital student experience. And right now we don't have any reason to put I don't want to say buzzwords, because it's not just buzzwords, but put things on top of that are not needed, if that makes sense. So we keep our eyes on the horizon, but we stay focused on the core for now, because it's getting the API documentation right to enable the universities to move away from their LMS is a big task, and it's something that's core infrastructure. And it's something that is not just for a small group of students, it's for all students, and has massive implications in terms of how people communicate with each other and learning outcomes and other things. And so right now we're just obsessively focused on getting that piece right. And we really see that in our results. And then there's a bit more room for experimentations later down the line.
Here's some questions. I mean, I can see how today's students, you talk about, Gen Z and so forth, I can see how, they're always on their mobile devices. They're used to tools that I haven't seen your product live, but I can imagine that that students might be very comfortable with it. What is your experience with faculty? How do faculty look at this? Are they just flummoxed, or do they see the light and jump in? And what's your experience been with faculty, especially the more traditional faculty?
Good question. So I think first, actually, I want to push a tiny bit back on the student point. I think there's a bit of a tendency, which is quite convenient for software companies, to generalize on what a student is. But actually, when you look at the institutions that we work with, the student populations are extremely diverse. They have lots of mature students, lots of people who are working. And I think that's where education is going. And so it's not just about people who are 18 years old who like using Snapchat. It's actually also about building tools that are accessible, that are convenient for people who are, for example, working part-time and are studying on a bus. And I think regardless of age or regardless of background, people generally have a preference for technology that's easy to use. And that's the same for faculty. I think when it comes to faculty adoption, a lot of people are just quite relieved that they have, you know, like you've had this senior leadership and education strategy that talks about collaboration and the fourth industrial revolution and like bring students together anywhere and everywhere. And then the LMS is just a bit of an elephant in the backyard. So most faculty just absolutely love using the product. I was looking at one of the surveys from last term, which was talking about the extent to which Aula helps them create more engaging learning experience. And it's more than 90% of faculty who is to say yes or a strong yes. So we really have a lot of, like, faculty is what pushes the product forward. However, there is one piece that I think a lot of software companies don't get right, is that digital is really about culture, change is about people. And so one of the things we do is that we don't just sell software. We always sell it with a member of our implementation team working actively with the institution to think about what it is we're trying to achieve. And that includes project management. That includes being active in thinking about what are the workshops that will help academics become familiar with the product. That includes thinking about automation of content migration and how that content will change once it's arrived inside of Aula, and really making it a good experience for academics to think about how to engage their students. And I think that's probably the part of what we're doing that I'm the most proud of at the moment, is that everyone asked the question that you were asking. But actually, I think a lot of the sort of, what can you say, like the biggest problem we're trying to solve are not really related to that. They're more related about to making sure that the infrastructure makes sense at scale as well. So making sure that we have robust SIS integrations and things like this. It's not really about getting faculty to believe that engaging learning experiences are better, because most faculty definitely believe that, if not all. I think we definitely have that going for us. People have a tendency to think that academics don't want these things to happen. I increasingly have the opinion that one of the reasons they don't want it to happen is that they have really bad experiences with technology. And that's partly because they've used a lot of technology that's way worse than what's used outside of education.
Yeah. You shouldn't have to spend all your time figuring out, how many clicks, where do I have to click to do this, to accomplish this and that. And I'm very... I understand faculty that are used to sitting down in a seminar with their students or in a small lecture hall, where they have some conversation and getting them to transition to an online environment. I can really sympathize with them. Well, listen, I do want to be respectful of your time. I guess one of the curiosities that I have is, can you tell us about a success story where, an institution was actually able to really put their LMS in the background or get rid of it altogether?
Yeah, I think so. One of the institutions we worked with first was a creative arts institution in London called Ravensbourne. It's 2,500 students. Lots of commuter students. Many of the students are first generation in university. And it's the architecture of its building is very much focused on a sort of studio-based approach to teaching and learning. And so they had a learning management system. We started a pilot with them in September 2017. And one of the things that was quite clear from that pilot was that, as I mentioned before, really that Aula could help the institution provide students with a sense of belonging, create these communities of learners and students and just create a more engaging learning experience. And that institution now uses Aula for all their students. And actually one thing that's quite interesting is that not only do we see significant increases in all the sort of relevant metrics and analytics and survey results compared to the LMS, we also see that it becomes better and better once the institution is using Aula. So if you take, for example, the daily active use, like a year ago when they were on Aula compared to now, there's a massive like uptake. So they use Aula a lot in the beginning and now they use Aula even more. And I think that's just people familiarizing themselves with the product becoming better and better. But also just it takes time to change behavior in terms of driving and creating a more conversational social approach to pedagogy that really engages students. And I think one of the things that excites me the most about our partner institutions is that it's not just something you get out of there and then it's over. It's a bit more of a journey where we can continue to see improvements in the results that we're delivering with the institutions.
It seems like that approach is certainly admirable. I'm just wondering, it seems like it would be expensive to scale something like that. It's unlike Canvas or another LMSs, which, you can pretty much take, just clone, their platform and just turn it over to them and integrate with the SIS and you're done.
The thing is, you're not done, right? And I think so I'll answer your question in just a second, but I think one thing that's interesting is a lot of platforms in education focused a lot on like whether a product is adopted, right? Like that was sort of the big battle between Blackboard and Canvas. But no one really cares about adoption. They care about like how it is adopted. Like in reality, that's what it's about. And so the question is, how do we create a combination of culture change and software that changes the behavior in a meaningful way? And as I mentioned before, we have great results. And coming back to your questions about scalability, how do you scale that impact? So one of the things Aula is not a free product. So institutions pay for our services. I think one important part of how to do it in a scalable manner is the way we think about our approach to implementation. There are a lot of things we do where we use, for example, the data from the institution in terms of engagement levels to provide academics with the right resources to help them create more engaging learning experiences. So that where other companies would need like 10 people, we need maybe like a half a person, right? So I don't think we'll ever get to the point where we become a software company that will suggest to not have our involvement in making sure that the product is adopted in the right way. So the way to scale that is to think intelligently about what are the things we can learn from our implementations that can ensure that products are adopted in the right way at scale without costing a fortune. So I think we've taken a very pragmatic approach there, and I think we'll start to see more and more technology companies come to that realization where it's not the sort of you get us on the phone, you get the keys to the software, and then that's it. Because digital is becoming so important, and I think you can see that in any university in the world. It actually requires thought to think about what is the right way to do it. And that's reflected in the way that we work. And when the institutions ask us, can we just get access to the platform? The answer is no.
Right.
Because we want to get it right. We don't want any implementations where we've not worked with the institution in a way to provide those results at scale. And that's not just about software. That's about driving culture change, making sure that people understand why they're doing certain things and making sure they understand the pedagogical rationale behind the platform.
Well, on that note, I think it's a good note to stop on. I'll tell you, it's your approach is very refreshing. You know, it's not that, we're going to do a spreadsheet and list your features against some other LMS, like you say. Your focus is, a communication platform for education and very customizable. And, it's intriguing. And I think it will be to a lot of people to think that, gee, maybe I don't need a learning management system anymore. So I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much, Rodney. I hope we get an opportunity to meet in the not too distant future. I really enjoyed the podcast.
All right. Take care.
Thanks a lot.
That's it for today. I hope you enjoyed the interview. I think you'll agree that Aula is a force to reckon with. They seem to have a new paradigm for building a learning platform, and I'll be anxious to see how they progress. Stay tuned for the full song, Woods of Chaos, by Rob Koslow. And until next time, have a great week. Thank you.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog or send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.